Well, it's striking to me that an astute European visitor, the French nobleman Alexis de Tocqueville, identified back in the 1830s one of the most important characteristics of the young American culture that remains today one of our most pressing dilemmas: whether it is more important to be independent or interdependent. You know, our story today that I enjoyed a lot is a great example of some of the cultural tension that we have about this question. We try to teach children to express themselves, to be individuals, to be nonconformists, and at the same time, we want them to play well with others, not to be rude to their teachers, and not to play their music so loud so that they bother the neighbors. It's understandable historically why this question of independence versus interdependence became America's signature cultural tension. This country began as a vast and sparsely settled space that European migrants invaded, took over a very different space from the densely populated and sophisticated countries from which they had come. Many of these earliest settlers were fleeing political and religious oppression and saw the New World as a land of liberation from tyranny. What rulers these colonies had were far away, and everybody had to be self-reliant. If you could grow your food and keep a respectable, polite distance from your neighbor, your personal freedom was limited only by the weather and your luck. De Tocqueville's picture of self-reliant individualism in America is two centuries along from those earliest settlements, but he recognizes what we might call the DNA of that original American experience carrying on from generation to generation. Now, a lot changed in those two centuries into the 1830s. Population grew, cities were built, independence was declared, and constitutions and covenants and laws for how people had to live together in closer proximity and closer dependence on each other needed to be framed. Because the King of England was the head of the Church of England, it's no surprise that at the time of the American Revolution, no one questioned that political liberation and spiritual liberation were closely linked. At least if you understand liberation as meaning simply the freedom to do and say what you please. To challenge the taxes imposed by the King of England was not much different than challenging the edicts of the Archbishop of Canterbury or the Pope. Freedom was understood by the new kinds of Protestant churches that emerged from the American Revolution more as freedom from authority and not freedom to articulate any new and different vision of what spiritual liberation might mean, until the Transcendentalist movement that emerged just at the time that de Tocqueville visited America in the 1830s. Especially we think of the works of Ralph Waldo Emerson in this regard. Less influenced by the struggle for political freedom than the generation of intellectual leaders that had preceded him, Emerson focused on spiritual freedom. In his two 1841 essays on self-reliance and on spiritual laws, he gave seemingly contradictory advice about how to live a religious life that did not rely on traditional Protestant Christian authority, but instead on the authority of the free mind and heart. So here are some words from these two essays. See what you think. From Self-Reliance: "No law can be sacred to me but that of my nature. A man is to carry himself in the presence of all opposition as if everything were titular and ephemeral but he. I am ashamed to think how easily we capitulate to badges and names, to large societies and dead institutions. I ought to go upright and vital and speak the rude truth in all ways." But in the same book, another essay called Spiritual Laws, he writes, "A little consideration of what takes place around us every day would show us that a higher law than that of our will regulates events. There is a soul at the center of the universe and over the will of every person so that none of us can wrong the universe. It has so infused its strong enchantment into nature that we prosper when we accept its advice. The whole course of things goes to teach us faith. We need only obey. Certainly there is a possible right for you that precludes the need of balance and willful election. For you there is a reality, a fit place, and congenial duties. Place yourself in the middle of the stream of power and wisdom which animates all upon which it floats, and you are without effort impelled to truth, to right, and to perfect contentment." How can these two statements make sense coming from the same pen? One, a seemingly supreme expression of confidence in the self-reliant person, and the other, an instruction to obedience and surrender to the spiritual laws that are evident in the universe, rather than believing your own will to be supreme. I have thought about this, and I guess the answer I found is that Emerson believed that trusting your own instincts, your own intelligence, your own experience is critical for living a religious life of integrity. But at the same time, the more that you do this, the more honestly you engage with your own life and experience, you realize again and again that your life is not your own possession. It belongs to others. It belongs to the world and to the way the world really is, rather than to anybody's story that they tell you about the way the world is. Your deepest happiness will come from giving that one precious life you have away to those whom you love and to the ideas, the values, the movements, the convictions that will make the world a home where all people can find their fulfillment. And I think that this is what Unitarian Universalism, as a uniquely American faith tradition influenced by Transcendentalism, has come to embody in our world today. It is our path between the extremes of independence and interdependence, and it is our commitment to unite these two life tasks into a single life of integrity. Today, in the spirit of that path and that commitment, I'm not really sure whether what I'm offering you today is a sermon about growing in spirit or leading in social justice. In some of the feedback that we got to the State of the Fellowship sermon last month, these two parts of the mission of the fellowship were sometimes contrasted, with people sounding in some of their comments as if they were part of two different political parties sitting on opposite sides of the aisle in our sanctuary. But as Parker Palmer has told us in the reading that we've heard, our challenge is not to see these as opposites, but see them in creative tension with each other, allowing each other, each to check the other's darker potentials. And he called this a key democratic habit of the heart. In the same way, in this congregation, we seek to hold our respect for the sacred conscience of each individual's mind and heart in a creative tension with our desire to lead in social justice together, collectively, to use our collective power within and because of this community to be a unique voice in our area for compassion, tolerance, and equality. That is our key spiritual habit of the heart. Now, in this strange season of political campaigning that we are now enduring, we find ourselves struggling to make sense of whether and how American political parties are still representative of this tension between individualism and communalism. In these strange times, the old corrals that conservatives and liberals were supposed to gather in seem to have fallen apart. And we find the elephants and the donkeys wandering and grazing where they will over any number of issues that they used to be identified with, but they're not in the same fields anymore. Surprising coalitions are being formed and defined by a single or a small number of positions rather than by any candidate's comprehensive platform, record, or character. So if you are mind-boggled by hearing radio interviews with voters who say they are torn between Trump and Sanders, you are not alone. What is a religious liberal to do in this strange new political world? And does the 24-hour news cycle noise, the barrage of the ads, I know you haven't had this yet in Wisconsin, it's coming. You got some for Judge, right? And the constant adversarial conflict that seems to be a part of both political campaigns and the various forms of justice work that you are routinely invited to engage in. Does all of this make you feel like you want to close the door, light a candle, and just meditate? Can we do both? Should we do both? I enjoyed Connie's reflection this morning because she shared not only her own passion for social justice, but her own doubts about where she finds the right balance between always doing, and just being in her life. It's a challenging problem, and I enjoyed reading the Buddhist teacher and social activist Donald Rothberg, who wrote a book that our publishing house, Beacon Press, published called The Engaged Spiritual Life. He says, "I believe that many of us feel genuinely called to a vision of our lives in which inner and outer transformation are connected, knowing that we don't have to do everything, that there are many aspects to transformation, frees us further to listen for a calling, a vocation, for the very specific ways in which we might live this vision." And I didn't actually share this little piece of the sermon with Connie before she gave her reflection, but it's exactly what she said. The title that I put on today's sermon, "It Is What It Is," is a line that I got from the mayor of Cleveland, who uses it a lot at press conferences as a way of saying no comment about all manner of situations he can't control, but where the reporters want him to give a soundbite opinion. And sometimes I really like it when he uses that line. It feels like a liberating recognition for a politician. And sometimes it bothers me. So let me give you an example. On the one hand, I've heard this mayor, this political leader, say this, looking at things with an honest and dispassionate eye. For example, the state legislature is controlled by Republicans. They have cut payments to local governments. It's done. It's not going to change. And as a result, we have a big hole in the local government budget that threatens essential services. It is what it is. So today I'm asking you to support a local tax increase. I get that. But sometimes the line bothers me. I can hear it as a different kind of expression that gets under my skin. It can sound like resignation and complacency. I've heard you say this about problems that don't seem to get much better, no matter how hard you work on them, such as persistent poverty or income inequality at home, or racism, or the Israeli-Palestinian controversy. And the way I hear that line then is, this is an intractable problem. It has nothing to do with me, so why should I get involved? When what is about our world seems too complicated or depressing to think, just to think about or engage with, this is exactly when the spiritual life of practice and reflection that you have built into your everyday routines becomes so important. Because it's creating the foundation for everything else, and particularly for your service or your justice work. I like to imagine the life that I am living as a home that I am always building and improving. And you want it to have rooms that are for all the parts of your life that invite your attention every week. You want rooms where you can just take care of yourself and your body. You want room that's a private space to share with your family and friends closest to you. And you want rooms that are dedicated to your public life, a room where you can work, where you can hold and give away goods, or where you can meet people to talk about the world in which we live. But, you know, you don't build a house on bare ground. It'd be hard to keep those rooms at any stable temperature, and every time the seasons outside changed, you'd have to change the way you use those rooms. And some of them might become unusable. Being grounded in practices of study, of contemplation, of generosity, that draw on the best wisdom that you have found about the way the world is absolutely essential to each of us as a foundation for our life's house. And there are lots of possibilities for the materials you can use in that foundation. And we offer lots of opportunities here to explore different paths and practices. Mine is built on my lifelong Unitarian Universalism, my upbringing, my values and community life as a Unitarian Universalist, and on my Buddhist spiritual practice. Yours might be different. But without such a foundation, the commitment to include in your house room for activism, for being a volunteer, for being a person connected to the interdependent life we share together is a much easier thing, because it's not a duty. It's just one more aspect of who you are. I think this is the key teaching in Donald Rothberg's work. We don't all have to be on the front lines, he says, in every demonstration or attending directly to those in greatest need to be of great help. We can follow a vocation that might not be seen immediately as that of an activist, say, teaching children or being involved in community gardening. Yet that vocation can represent a deep response to the suffering of our society. I may not be on the front lines, but I know I am part of the same basic work and that all our contributions are necessary and are connected. There's no right way for you to give your life to the world and make it a better place. You have a vocation that is calling to you, not a duty to perform. In my Buddhist practice, I've learned that there are only two things that I know for sure: that we are born and that we will die. Everything else is the words that we weave into stories and statements that try to describe what we can expect and hope in this journey between birth and death, and try to describe what ultimately may be indescribable. Some of those stories at times sound pretty convincing to me, but I come back to knowing just these two things: that everything changes and is impermanent. Impermanence is what is for me. And some people find that depressing or dismiss that view as resignation or complacency. I find it liberating, even exhilarating. It's liberating because it challenges you to be suspicious and humble about all the stories that are told to you about the way things are, and about all of the many ways that people have organized human structures of truth and power that we take for granted because those who built them have the authority of time behind them. Understanding impermanence is liberating because it challenges you to not have all the happiness you draw from your labor depend on its outcomes. The outcomes will change, and our imaginations around these structures of truth and power that we build are so limited. We can't possibly foresee what will happen in the future to a career, a family, a cause that we may have given our life to. So you do the best you can, but you don't do it because the outcomes are going to prove to you that you did your best. The satisfaction of knowing that you did is profoundly meaningful in and of itself. And I think that's true of every activity of every day. I worry that in our American society, too many people grow up with the idea that what it means to be happy is to be emotionally or financially independent of the obligations and demands of others. And this is such a limited picture of what freedom really means. Freedom, as the liberation that is described in so many religious traditions, is having the ability to discern the choices about how to live your life, reflecting what Emerson called the spiritual laws, the deep rhythms of human existence in our world that are beyond our words to capture. And a friend of mine once described that kind of freedom this way, as seeing that you are in a left-turn-only lane and appreciating that you have a clear and joyful desire to turn left, and knowing that this is exactly where you should be, is what it is.